everyone. Bob Main with another episode of today's Survival Show. Episode number 85, to be exact. It's April 21st, 2010. It's a gorgeous spring day in North Texas, Dallas-Fort Worth area. Nearly 80 degrees, partly sunny. Man, I love this time of year. This is absolutely my favorite time of year. And if you're listening for the first time, you're going to find this is a practical show, 30 minutes of podcasting freedom here. I talk about common sense ideas that help us live a better life today. I don't get into a lot of tinfoil hat kind of conspiracies, theories, and paranoid thinking and stuff like that. I leave that to other people. This is a show rooted in common sense, and I like to keep it that way. And in the last episode, I talked about what's most likely to threaten your life. This is somewhat of a follow-up, and I'm going to talk specifically about violent encounters in this show. There's a good website I've been reading a lot lately called NoNonsenseSelfDefense.com. Mark McYoung at NoNonsenseSelfDefense.com. I'm going to paraphrase some of the stuff on his website today. I'm going to add a little bit of flavor of my own to it because I've got a little bit of experience with this and a little bit of training in this, so I'm going to kind of twist it my way, but that's the basis of it. And we're going to talk about what a violent encounter really is and what self-defense really is. A lot of people have a misconception of what self-defense is. A lot of folks think that because you're carrying a gun, you're okay. Or because you're carrying a knife, you're okay. Or because you're a trained martial artist, you're okay. And that can sometimes lead people into a false sense of security that's not very good. In fact, sometimes that false sense of security can actually get you into more trouble. And that's what I want to try to talk to you about and help you avoid it. So this is going to be probably a two-part series. This is going to be part number one, and part number two is going to be in episode 86. And I'll probably publish episode 86 on Friday. This is Wednesday the 21st, as I mentioned. Some of you may not listen to it till Thursday, so you may get a chance to get podcasts from me on back-to-back days. But my intention in this show is to inform you about some of the realities, some of the complexities, some of the things that you're going to encounter in a violent situation. It's a tough task, but I'm going to take it on and see what I can do. Okay? Before I jump into that, I want to do about 60 seconds worth of announcements and get them out of the way here. The website, todayssurvival.com. iTunes, you can find this show on Today's Survival Show if you just search that on iTunes. Hey, iTunes users, I need to ask you to do me a favor, if you would, please. Would you go to iTunes, if you haven't already, and rate the show? Good, bad, or indifferent, I don't care. It helps me improve the show. I'm an open-minded guy. I handle criticism well. I want this to be your show. As I've mentioned before, I'm just the Yankee behind the microphone. That's all. As you know, I was born in New York City, raised in Wisconsin. I call Wisconsin my home. I'm a cheesehead, but I transplanted myself here to Dallas in 93. I'm just a Yankee behind the microphone. This is your show. I love some of the topic suggestions been coming my way. Understand something. If you send me a show suggestion, I'm going to take it to heart, and I'm going to figure out a way to get it into a podcast. I may not do it right away, but I promise you, I will get it in. And also check out the YouTube channel. You can go to youtube.com/user/todayssurvival, or just search Today's Survival on YouTube. That's it. That's all it is for the announcements. I like to keep this short and sweet. I don't like to make my show real commercial. So let's go ahead and dive into it. Self-defense is really, in my opinion, not about hitting somebody. It's not about the weapons that you carry. And some of you who know me, you know I like to conceal carry. I'm a big proponent of that. But that's not all that there is to self-defense. It's not about having a huge attitude the size of Texas either. It's a lot more complex than that. In order to be proficient at defending yourself against a violent encounter, it's a matter of having the knowledge and the awareness, the situational awareness, and understanding the appropriate behaviors that you should display to try to avoid getting into a bad situation. That's pretty much what I'm talking about. And you have to be able to apply some of the knowledge and the awareness right away, on the spot. It's about immediately being able to recognize danger. It's about immediately being able to recognize when things are starting to develop around you. The thing I want you to realize is you're probably not going to have much time to react. So I'm going to talk to you about making this stuff a reflexive response. You know, as you know, I've talked about my mentor, Tom Hopkins, and how he taught me about the five steps of the learning process. And I thought it'd be a good idea to review the five steps of the learning process before I jump into the self-defense stuff. Those five steps being, at first, when you first learn something, you're unconscious incompetent. It means you don't know that you don't know what you're doing. And hopefully that's when your mind starts to learn. So then you become conscious incompetent. In other words, now you know you don't know what you're doing, and your mind is opening, and you're starting to enter the learning phase because your mind's like a parachute. It works best when it's open. After you leave the conscious incompetent level, then you graduate to the conscious competent, where now you're consciously aware that you know what you are doing. And you say to yourself, hey, okay, I'm starting to get this stuff. Then after you leave conscious competent, you become unconscious competent. In other words, you're so good at what you do, you unconsciously do it automatically. You don't even have to think about it. It's second nature. And then you go to step number five, where everything becomes a reflexive response. You start operating on reflex. You start operating on instinct rather than even thinking about it. So those are pretty much the five steps of the learning process, and they definitely apply to situational awareness. And I want you to recognize and understand something. Taking care of yourself is not a standalone issue. What I mean by that, what I'm talking about, is not it's not just something that you learn and then stick it in a closet and use it if you're ever attacked. Okay? What I'm going to talk to you about on this show not only helps you handle violent situations, but it can also be used daily to make your life easier, less stressful, and less filled with conflict. And that's really what we all want, isn't it? I mean, I do. I don't know about you, but that's what I want. Less stress. You know, and in the last episode, I talked about what is most likely to threaten your life. I talked about what can kill you. You know, a lot of survivalists spend a lot of time putting away food and building bug out bags and first aid kits and things like that. You know, first aid and techniques like that, good kits and good techniques, yes, that can save your life. Putting away food, sure, it could save your life if it's a prolonged disaster where you can't, where you don't have any access to food for quite a while. Being debt-free reduces the stress in your life. Having plenty of water stored reduces the stress and keeps you alive if there's a disaster long enough to keep you away from water for 4 or 5 days. Good, clean water. Okay? Exercising, having a fitness program helps you keep in shape so you can avoid heart disease and a lot of things that cause cancer. Obviously, doing things, using your head, like not abusing tobacco and not abusing alcohol and drugs. You know, these are the types of killers. Learning to be safe on the roadways. All right, because car accidents is a huge killer of people. All these are bigger killers than natural disasters, but let's not forget about violent encounters. Even though violent encounters might be maybe 6th, 7th, 8th on the list as to what could kill you, it's a lot more possible than dying in a natural disaster. So, the reason I'm going there with all of this that I'm talking about is that reducing the stress and knowing that you have the ability to recognize if violence is developing around you is so important. And I've mentioned so many times that what we do today matters and that we should thrive today so that we can survive tomorrow. So I want to talk to you about an old saying. There's an old saying that says violence just doesn't come out of nowhere. And that's so true. Even if it seems like it's jumped out of the bushes at you, that's your perception of violence. What really, really happened, folks, is that violence took time, it took action, and it took effort on behalf of the perpetrator to develop to the point to where it turned violent. And sometimes, even if we're just an innocent person minding our own business, sometimes we do and say things that can contribute to someone who's out of control or starting to get out of control turning violent. And in this show and in the next show, I'm going to use some of the stuff from NoNonsenseSelfDefense.com to talk about how to avoid that. So really, violence doesn't just jump out of nowhere most of the time. Okay? And so in this article, he makes a really good point. Mr. McYoung makes a really good point. He says that as with any safety issue, what you think you know can kill you. And it's really true in what seems to be a normal circumstance. Because a lot of times normal circumstances are really something else. You think you know what's going on, but you really don't. Okay, and that's where the danger signals sometimes get misinterpreted or ignored. And all of a sudden the situation blows up. Now it's violence. Now you don't know, you didn't see it coming. Now you got a violent situation on your hands and you wonder, oh crap, what do I do now? Okay? And the problem is a lot of times that behaviors that don't have any consequences at all under a normal circumstance could result in you being attacked in other circumstances. And that's why violence can be such an unexpected shock to people and seem like it comes out of nowhere. Okay? You could have done something hundreds of times and you were never assaulted or bothered by it. But, you know, all of a sudden something terribly goes wrong suddenly. And there's a lot of other factors that go into violence that begins to escalate. One of the factors is that the violent person is there and he sees that there's a likelihood of him getting away with it. And when something suddenly terribly goes wrong and the violent person thinks that he can get away with the violence, when these two things combine, that's when the results get very explosive. So being able to recognize these things and knowing when not to do certain things is a big element to preserving your safety and not being being attacked. All right, so let me share some easy to understand pointers on this subject, but realize that these are kind of complex issues, but it's really not that difficult to understand if you dig deep into it, and so that's what I'm going to do. Okay? Avoiding becoming a victim can be pretty easy. If you just think about it, practice it, and go over it, over and over it several times in your mind. Crime and violence are really not simple problems, and the people that are just looking for a just do it answer, too many people are just looking for a real simplistic, hey, all you gotta do is just do this and do this every time, and you'll avoid violence. It's the same process that a criminal goes through to perpetrate violence. You have to go through a similar process to try to avoid it. That's what I'm talking about. But it is a process that works. You have to know several different angles. You have to be able to recognize different things around you starting to happen. But those of us who want an easy fix, we're not going to get it. So the bad news is that when it comes to preventing violence and stopping crime, nearly everything that you think might be a just do it, just do this answer, doesn't really work. So let me ask a couple of questions here. Tell me if you've heard this, or if you've heard people say this, or if somebody has told you this about personal safety. Has anybody ever said, or have you heard people say, just carry your keys sticking out between your fingers? Or just carry a personal alarm. The personal alarm will scare away the attacker. Remember those? You remember those things? You just pull the ripcord and those things, like 120 decibel noise or something like that would come out of them. I remember when those things were being sold left and right and people were buying tons of those. And you were being sold a line, hey, this is all you need. Or how about this? How about, has somebody ever said, just carry a gun, that's enough. Just keep a gun with you. You know, folks, I'm a big proponent of concealed carry. You know that. And some of you listen to my Handgun World show, you know that that's all I talk about over there on that show. It's a gun-related show. But I am smart enough to know that just keeping that gun with me is not going to keep me safe. And in fact, if I develop a reckless attitude, it could get me in trouble. A lot of people that carry guns like to use the term, well, I'd rather be judged by 12 than carry by 6. And I've used that term. Okay, but when I use that term, I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6, I don't mean that I'm going to go out and take unnecessary chances and go out there looking for trouble, pull my gun out, and shoot somebody and hope that the rest of it works out later. That's not what I'm talking about, but unfortunately there are people who have that attitude. Or you've heard people say, Al, all you have to do is know some martial arts techniques, kick them in the pressure points, kick them in the groin, you're going to be fine. That's not quite the truth either. People say, well, don't look at the scary person. If you don't look at him, don't make eye contact. He's going to leave you alone. That's not completely true. Or you've heard people say, there's no rules in a street fight. Well, that's questionable. Or people say to you, well, just take a good martial arts class. All you got to do is know martial arts. It teaches you self-defense. Hey, you know what? You've heard me talk about my son many times. You know, my son's 12 years old. By the time before he's 14, he'll be a black belt in mixed martial arts. But even his instructor teaches him that, hey, look, what we teach you in this class, kids, is going to help you. It's going to help you get out of a situation, but it shouldn't make you overconfident, and you can't go around looking for trouble, and you're going to need a lot more tools than this. You have to use your head. You have to use your head before you use your body. And that's a lot of what my son learns in mixed martial arts. This is a good school. This is not a martial arts school that teaches cage fighting. This is a good one where they teach you the mental aspects of it too. And they teach him how to avoid and how to use your head and stay out of danger. So everything I've just talked about are very dangerous assumptions if you think that way or you've been told to think that way. And as long as you never have to try to use any of these, they work great. Okay? They work great at making you feel safe unless you actually have to try to use your gun or use your martial arts skills or carry your keys between your fingers and try to poke somebody in the eye with them. There's a huge difference, folks, between feeling safe and actually being safe. Feeling safe should be a result of being safe. I'll say that again. Feeling safe should really be a byproduct of actually being safe. An example that Mark uses in this article is that a lot of women like to walk around alone at night, or they go through a deserted college campus or some dark parking area because their attitude is, well, I know kickboxing, I know taekwondo, I take martial arts, I can take care of myself. And it might be true that she could fight off some drunken frat boy, but she's probably not real prepared to handle some monster that's attacking her that doesn't care if she's alive or dead when he rapes her. And the sad truth about that is that having so much of that false confidence, her actions start to increase her chances of meeting that monster. And unfortunately, a lot of people who carry guns fall into the same trap. As I mentioned, they feel like all they need to do is carry, and they're going to be all right. And that false confidence sometimes causes them to do and say things that they wouldn't normally do and actually get them into trouble that they weren't expecting to get into. Okay, so the reason that violence is such a complex subject is that because it's a human dynamic. Humans are never only about one thing. Humans are complex emotional beings. They're not cookie cutter in their reactions. And a level of force that would be unacceptable to one type of person might be perfectly acceptable, perfectly reasonable to another type of person, because that's how they were raised. That's how they grew up. A lot of it has to do with their upbringing and their social situation. And some people, folks, unfortunately, they are raised with a complete disregard for other human lives. It's the truth. I know it's something we don't want to think about. And it's hard for me to even do podcasts like this because it's a negative part of our society that I don't care to think about. But you know what? It's real. And to ignore it is reckless as well. And this is why people who teach good self-defense say things like, well, it really depends on the situation, or each situation dictates a different response. There's so many different variables that have to be identified. And a process that should be done for every single encounter is something that is really, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say here is every encounter is different. There's no cure-all answer to keeping you safe. Okay? So let's get back to some of those examples I talked about earlier. A lot of so-called defense experts, they'll go ahead and tell you, you know, carry your keys clenched in your hand so you can poke the attacker's eyes out. All right? And another way to look at that is that you're ready for trouble mindset that you get into by doing this is what is really doing the job of fending off the attacker. It's your mindset. It's not the fact that you got your keys in your hands stuck out between your fingers so you can claw his eyes out. Your body language, folks, is a lot bigger deterrent to small-time punks and small-time attackers. They're a lot bigger deterrent than your keys are, your attitude. Now, again, not getting overzealous to where you start a fight or escalate a fight, but just your attitude that you have an aura of confidence about you. But here's the tricky part, is no matter what your level of confidence is, sometimes trouble finds you. I've always said that. You may not go looking for trouble, but sometimes trouble finds you. And if trouble comes your way, you need to be ready. Unexpectedly clawing his face with your keys, you know, like I said, it might work if you got some panhandler or some street person that wants to do you harm. But you got to be careful with that. Sometimes that's not self-defense. You have to understand that sometimes you might be considered as assaulting somebody. Okay? If you claw their eyes with your keys, you've just assaulted somebody with an item. And you know, and there's a lot of states, folks, that have crazy laws that that would charge you for aggravated assault or assault with a deadly weapon for something like that. In the eyes of the law, in a lot of states, unfortunately, that bum has just as many rights as you do, and now you just attacked him with your keys or your pocket knife, whatever it was. And unless you can very well articulate why it was self-defense, it's going to be your word against his. He's the one who's bleeding and hurt, and he's the one that's going to appear to a jury to have a stronger case, especially if you get a lot of mamby-pambies on that jury that... And maybe you live in a country or a state where there's a lot of people like that that will just like to, you know, lock up any aggressor. And even if you tried to defend yourself, they sometimes don't see it that way. In a little while, I'm going to let you hear an audio clip by Masad Ayoub. Masad Ayoub is an excellent lethal force instructor. He's got some really good stuff to say. I'm going to play that for you probably here in about 5 minutes or so. And he talks about the consequences of using lethal force. But you also have to remember there's a lot of people out there that if you gouge their face with your keys, they'll snap your neck. They'll shoot you or stab you. That's what violent people do to those who inflict pain and not injury onto them. And on the other extreme, if you're going to carry a gun or a knife for self-defense, then you better know when you're legally and morally and ethically justified in using it. And that's what Masad Ayoub's going to talk about here in a few minutes. Keep in mind that there are established standards. Even here in Texas, where I live, there are established standards at when you can use lethal force. In this state, it might be a lot more lax than in other states. But there are definitely still some rules. Now, you know, if you react out of fear or anger, then you're going to go to jail. I'll say that again. If you react out of fear or anger, then you're probably going to go to prison for assaulting somebody. It doesn't matter if you use your keys. It doesn't matter even if you use your fists. You're probably going to get arrested and go to jail. And it's not really a matter of going to jail for attempted self-defense. It's because in states that are like that, in states or countries that don't like to recognize a person's right to defend themselves, people, the juries and the judges often sometimes think that you've crossed over from defending yourself to attacking somebody. And so with that, I think this is a good time for me to go ahead and turn this audio soundbite on. Now, Masad Ayoub is a firearms lethal force instructor. And I want you to listen to him talk about what is justifiable self-defense, what's justifiable homicide, what's accidental homicide. You're going to learn a lot from this. The first time I listened to it, I thought, you know, a lot of this makes sense because, you know, he's going to talk about the legal aspects of trying to avoid violence here. All right, so listen to this. It's not very long, and I got some comments. I'll come back on when he's done, but here you go.
Okay, let's talk about deadly force. First, the definition of deadly force or lethal force. The terms are interchangeable and will appear differently in the codes and the statutes. Deadly force or lethal force is that degree of force that a reasonable person would consider capable of causing death or grave bodily harm. It is that degree of force which a reasonable and prudent person would consider capable of causing death or grave bodily harm. Why do we not fire warning shots? Well, we can give you a list of reasons an arm long. But one of them that no one seems to mention is it's an act of deadly force. If you fire a gun somewhere in the direction of another human being, is that not the degree of force a reasonable person would consider capable of causing death or grave bodily harm? Within the last year in Manchester, New Hampshire, we had a man who fired a warning shot, fired it just like on TV, elevate the gun slightly, put it into the air. It strikes a woman on the porch of an apartment building in Manchester. The bullet enters her heart, and she dies from that warning shot. Anybody want to speculate on what that old boy's chances were in court? Okay. It was a case of a person possessing a power they did not know how to command, and tragedy resulted from it. Okay, is that degree of force that can cause death or grave bodily harm? The statutes in the 50 states may describe grave bodily harm differently. Let me give you the layman's explanation that will cover you in all 50. Crippling injury. Crippling injury. At least one state says any broken bone is grave bodily harm. Does that mean if one of you comes up here, accidentally steps on my foot and breaks my little toe, I can blow your ass off? According to that statute book, it is. That statute is poorly defined. Crippling injury. Okay, the use of deadly force means you don't fire unless you are authorized to kill that human being. You do not fire the gun unless you're in a situation where you know you're on solid legal ground if you shoot and kill the person on the other end of the gun. So let's begin here by defining the levels of homicide, if you will, as are seen through our law and through the common law from which our law derives. Now first, let me tell you, I'm not an attorney. If you want legal advice, go see your attorney. I don't give legal advice. I am not a law professor. If you want to learn the law, go to law school. What I am and what I'm certified to do is a lethal force instructor, and I teach lethal force. I teach the rules of the road. Thus far, every single attorney who's been through the program told us at the end they learned more about deadly force at LFI than they did at law school. And we'll ask the attorneys in this class if that was true this coming Friday. I would like to believe that's because, you know, we're great instructors. Actually, we're arrogant enough to believe that we are great instructors. But it's mainly, unfortunately, the fact that in law school, deadly force law is just a tiny drop in a great sea of tort law, contract law, and much more frequently applied criminal law. The average attorney will never try a homicide case except perhaps in moot court in law school. Of those who do, the criminal law practitioners, the specialists in the field, I've met a number who never defended an innocent man who fired in self-defense. Okay, in any given year, I will accept and in many cases take to trial approximately 20 justifiable homicide cases, which seem to split about 50-50 between armed citizens who fired in self-defense and police officers who fired in the line of duty and, in my opinion, are being wrongfully charged with some degree of homicide or wrongfully sued in a wrongful death action. And generally, based on the attorneys I've interacted with, I've handled more self-defense cases than the great majority of the criminal defense bar. And it's from that experience that we speak here. I am a designated prosecutor with the Grantham Police Department because New Hampshire, to the best of my knowledge, is the one state that remains that allows a layman to be a trial advocate if he is a police officer and has had the special training to do so. Statewide, the police prosecutors are prevailing in approximately 90 to 95% of their cases against the fully empowered defense bar, which proves, among other things, something we long suspected. Cops know more about law than lawyers. But mainly, it proves that if right is on your side and truth is on your side, no matter how good the other guy is, if you get that truth across to the triers of the facts, you are going to win and the truth will set you free. I think you know me well enough by now to realize I am not Pollyanna. So take it from me when I tell you this. The truth will set you free. Never lie. There's a saying in America, you suck one cock, you're a cocksucker forever. You tell one lie in a trial, you're a liar forever. And for that moment, from that moment on, your credibility is down the chute. Your life is down the chute. That gurgling sound you hear is your freedom going down the toilet. That's every nickel of your estate you ever worked for your children going into the pockets of some scumbag who, the night he attacked you, his only estate until then had been a buck knife and a heroin syringe. You've got to know the ground you're walking on. Anytime you draw the gun, you're walking on ice. What we're going to try to do here is teach you to walk where the ice is thick. Okay, the levels of homicide. We'll begin with the one that's approved, justifiable homicide. Justifiable homicide. When the ruling is a justifiable homicide, the triers of the facts have said, in essence, you were right to kill him. You were right to kill him. They're all but saying you would have been wrong if you hadn't killed him. Now, they'll never go that far. The reason is, in American law, there is never a duty to kill, at least for the private citizen. That can be argued with law enforcement, but with a private citizen, there is never a duty to kill. There may be a right, but never a duty. If you see Charles Manson standing over Sharon Tate with a meat cleaver, you say to yourself, hey, I have this 44 Magnum, but I don't want to get involved. No one can criminally charge you for that. You'll have to spend the rest of your life every morning when you shave, looking in the mirror and seeing the face of a man who let an innocent person be slaughtered because they didn't have the courage to deal with it even though they had the means. But you'll never go to trial. The right to kill. That is largely what this course is going to be about, telling you when that right exists. When is it right to kill a human being? But for now, the verdict, justifiable homicide, means you are correct in firing that gun at that human being. The next level down is excusable homicide. Excusable homicide. It is becoming an archaic concept at law. In excusable homicide, the triers of the facts, judge and or jury, have said, okay, you probably shouldn't have killed them, but under the circumstances, anybody could have made the same mistake. Now, if you find it kind of hard to picture a situation like that, now you know why it's becoming an archaic concept at law. In the states that do have it, we're seeing the excusable homicide verdict applied in the situation of an accidental discharge of a firearm, an accidental shooting that could be traced to a malfunction in the weapon, a mechanical malfunction. I was saying, okay, you were still an idiot to have allowed it to point at the guy, but you couldn't have expected that it would go off when somebody bumped it, so, excusable homicide. Okay, next up, the one you're most likely to face in a self-defense shooting where they don't believe it was self-defense, is manslaughter. Manslaughter. When the verdict is manslaughter, the triers of the facts have said, okay, we know you didn't kill him intentionally. We know you didn't have any evil intent. But the fact is you acted with reckless, wanton disregard for human life. As a direct result of that, someone died who should not have died. That is manslaughter. Manslaughter means you have acted with a reckless and wanton disregard for human life. You reasonably knew or reasonably should have known that your actions would endanger innocent human life. You did it anyway and someone died. It is manslaughter. You guys get out of here at 5 o'clock tonight and you go to the local gin mill and you're sitting here tossing back to Johnny Walker.
Okay, I sure like Masada Yoob's plain spoken manner. That's what I like. He pretty much tells it like it is. Sorry about the language in that, folks. But, like I said, he likes to pull no punches. Now, from this article on no-nonsense self-defense, let me share with you what they say. What is self-defense? Because it means some pretty specific things. The Wikipedia definition of self-defense is, use of force is justified when a person reasonably believes that it's necessary for the defense of oneself or another against the immediate use of unlawful force. However, a person must use no more force than appears reasonable in necessary circumstances. Now, you know, this is where sometimes it kind of gets my blood boiling. In some states, I believe in California is one of them, where you can't use more force than your attacker is using on you. Now, what kind of garbage is that? In other words, they say you can't use a greater amount of force than your attacker is coming at you with. I think that's just flat-out garbage. But, you know, unfortunately, in some states and some countries, that's the way it is. I just think that's garbage. If your life is being threatened or someone wants to harm you or maim you or break a limb or cut you or slice you, you can't use overwhelming force to stop them? That's just ludicrous in my mind. Like I said, it gets my blood boiling. I need to calm down here a little bit. Okay? So let me state the fact that self-defense is an affirmative defense. I'll say that again. An affirmative defense. And that means that by claiming self-defense, you're coming out and saying, I did it. Specifically, you're admitting to actions that are normally a crime. But you're saying that you did those actions in order to stop the same criminal act from being unjustly done to you. And once you claimed self-defense, you can't go back and say, well, I didn't really mean to do it. I didn't really mean that. You know, you've confessed already. Once you claim self-defense, you've already confessed to doing, like I said, what sometimes can be a crime. So the burden of proof is going to be on you to prove that you didn't really commit a crime. You were trying to save your life. And even if it started as self-defense, be careful not to cross the line. You know, you got to remember, you're no longer innocent until proven guilty if you lose, if you use the self-defense argument. And by confessing that you acted in self-defense, you're guilty until you can demonstrate differently. You have to prove that what you did was not only self-defense, but it was justified, as Masoud Ayoub talked about in that audio clip. It isn't self-defense just because you say it was. So, you know, you're going to have some explaining to do. And that's why it's important to know where your actions stop being self-defense and where it turns you into the aggressor or turns you into the criminal. If it's found in investigation that you crossed the line from self-defense to assault, guess what? You've just confessed to that too. Think about that. Okay, so I want to talk about the four boundaries of self-defense, then I'll wrap up the show, and I'll continue this topic in the next episode. But what makes self-defense so complicated is that most people are not actually defending their bodies. Usually they're trying to protect their emotions, they're trying to protect their pride. And that's what gets them into trouble. And the two most important standards for what is self-defense is as follows. First of all, the danger to you is physical. And it's not a maybe he might hurt me, or he could hurt me, or he might hurt me. It's that, hey, it's happening. He is hurting me. So again, the danger to you is physical, and it's already started. Keep that in mind. The two most important standards to judge what is self-defense. The danger to you is indeed physical and life-threatening, and it's already started. It's not that it might start, but it already has started. And the two biggest reasons for a self-defense situation to turn ugly and to turn into something else and get you in trouble is that you participated in the creation and the escalation of the situation. And again, don't escalate it. Don't participate it. Don't make things worse. The other is you didn't stop after the threat to you was passed. And this is what I talked about just a little while ago when I said emotions sometimes get the best of people. Pride sometimes get the best of people. Guys, you know, be careful. Make sure that you don't participate in escalating the problem, and make sure you stop after the threat is passed. Your goal in self-defense is not to kill the other person. Your goal is to get them to stop what they are doing, and this is a big mistake that people who carry a gun make, okay? You know, so many people are so worried about, well, you know, what happens if I kill the guy? You shouldn't be trying to kill the guy. You should just be trying to get him to stop doing what he's doing to you. Once he quits and runs or retreats, stop your self-defense tactics. Even if you're carrying a gun, stop pulling the trigger once he stops committing his act. Think of it like a square. Think of it like a square painted on the ground, okay? And as long as you stay inside the square, it's self-defense. If you step out of that square, now you're the attacker. Now you're the aggressor. Now it's not self-defense. You could find yourself in court, and you could find yourself in a whale of trouble. Okay? So in episode 86, I'm going to talk more about the 4 points in a lot more detail. The 4 points of making sure that the danger to you is physical, that the action is actually happening and not just might happen, and making sure that you don't participate in creating it or escalating the situation, and making sure that you stop after the threat was passed. I'll analyze those a little bit more in depth in episode number 86. But for now, I hope I've kind of laid the groundwork to get you thinking about avoiding violence, situational awareness, knowing what's going on around you. This episode was basically to start your mind thinking. I'll get into some more details in episode 86, but this was kind of to get your juices flowing, get you pondering this subject and thinking about what it is that you really are trying to do when you're defending yourself. And so with that, I want to say, this is Bob Main. Thanks for listening to another episode of today's Survival Show, where it's my goal to help you harness the power of choice, making good choices about how we react in self-defense to save your life and strengthen your resolve. And as Teddy Roosevelt said, do what you can with whatever you have, wherever you are. Thanks again for tuning in, folks. Please don't forget to support the show. Help me keep it going. Some of you have been great support. And don't forget to join the forum. Good discussion going on there about a lot of good survival topics. Until next time, folks, thanks again for tuning in, and I'll catch you later. Bye-bye.